This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. When you hear the word spinster, what image comes to mind? Thesaurus.com says, paraphrasing, a woman beyond the usual marriageable age. Spinster is used with disparaging intent and perceived as insulting. It implies negative qualities such as being fussy or undesirable. Synonyms include prig, prude, fuddy-duddy, and the list goes on. Well, our guest today certainly turns that image on its head. Kate Bullock is a writer and contributor to The Atlantic. She is single and in her 40s and is author of the book Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. Kate Bullock, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Let's start off by talking a bit about yourself. You are in your early 40s. You've had a number of serious romances over the years, but were never quite able to embrace long-term coupledom. Tell us about that.
Well, correct. And it was always, it felt unconscious. I was always choosing against or choosing not to do something without understanding why. I wasn't choosing to be single. I just was choosing not to marry. And I didn't understand myself for a very long time. And part of that was there wasn't a reflection, a positive reflection of being unmarried in the culture at large that I could see. So I felt pretty alone in my experiences.
Mm. We'll get to more of that in just a moment. But I do want to talk about the word spinster, which really has a negative, tired, dare I say, as a middle-aged woman myself, kind of dried out connotation. How did you, I'm sorry, but how did you come around to embracing the word spinster?
You know, I don't know where it began, but I have always loved the word spinster and the idea of the spinster. She has been to me a figure of self-reliance, autonomy, even a mysterious inscrutability. You know, the spinster goes home to her house and closes the door, and we have no idea what she's up to. We don't know what her private life is about. And so that's who the spinster has always been in my imagination, and I really don't know where that came from. And I was astonished to see how early back this went. When I started writing the book, I looked back into my journals and diaries from my late teens and early 20s. And there I was in my early 20s talking about my spinster wish, which was my code to myself for just the pleasures of being alone.
Spinster wish. So what is the word spinster's origin? Spinster's origin? I mean, do we know where it came from?
Yeah, we do. It arose in the Middle Ages as a occupational designation, like baker or fishmonger, to describe the people who spun wool into thread. So they were called spinners or spinsters. It was the only respectable way for women to work outside of the home. And the only women who could work outside of the home were those who didn't have children they had to take care of. So spinsters were generally young, unmarried women. And it was totally neutral, you know, word. And it didn't take on a negative connotation until colonial America, when we were building a country, a population. America needed every single woman to be procreating to the tune of 8.02 children per lifetime, you know. And so any woman who wasn't getting with that program, if by the age of 23 a woman wasn't married and getting pregnant, she was called a spinster and very scornfully. I mean, she was an actual menace to society. And if by 26 she was still unmarried, she was called a thornback, which was a species of flat, spiny fish.
Ooh, that's almost, yeah. Almost worse. Yeah. You really don't hear it too much, the word spinster, in 2015. Is this a word you use in conversation?
No, and that's one reason I wanted to use it as the title of the book, is that it's not a word any of us use seriously, but we all know what it means. We all agree on who we think the spinster is. And the word is called into use as a joke all the time, a self-deprecating, you know, generally by a single woman who is freaking out about, you know, if she's at a low point of her single life, looking for love, can't find but somebody, says, oh, I'm going to, you know, wind up a lonely old spinster with too many cats. So so that the specter of the spinster haunts us. And women, you know, far before they're even probably going to get married, you know, women are terrorizing themselves with that specter.
Yes. And Kate Bullock, you do write in the beginning of the book, whom to marry and when it will happen. These two questions define every woman's existence, regardless of where she was raised or what religion she does or doesn't practice. How do you come to that conclusion?
Well, just, I mean, that's what culture is. Our society is organized around the institution of marriage. So it's no coincidence that we are raised to, you know, believe that that's what we will do. And the pressure is stronger for women than it is for men. I mean, we all feel it. It's a gender neutral situation, marriage, but it's men are, you know, boys are still raised with a little more sense of agency over their own lives. And girls are raised still to fantasize about this someday my prince will come kind of thing. And it there's less agency involved with that. It's a girl is waiting to be chosen. She's waiting to be, you know, princess for a day, et cetera. It's a different set of concerns, and there's more passivity involved in that.
Well, I'm no scientist, but that kind of leads to another question. How much do you think is the expectation of marriage culture, and how much is biology?
Ooh, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, we won't get into hormones in this conversation. So let's get instead to family. You, Kate, were greatly, at least you write, you were greatly influenced by your mom, who married at 25, had two children, and died of breast cancer in middle age. Tell us a bit about your relationship with your mother.
Oh, we were so close. She was a wonderful mother, and she was a feminist and raised me to be a feminist, and she loved being a mother and loved being a wife. She was very happy in her life, but she, because she didn't have the confidence to pursue her ambitions to be a writer. She didn't have the time because she was taking care of my brother and me, and she didn't start pursuing her own ambitions until her mid to late 30s. And so to watch her come into her own like that was really exciting. She was such a strong and formidable person. You know, she really flowered into a very bold self. And then to have her die suddenly was, I mean, just, you know, terrible loss on a personal level. But then also it just felt so cruel that, you know, didn't have much time to enjoy her own powers. And that really left a mark on me. I felt strongly that I wanted to become a writer, that she had raised me to be whatever woman I could be, right? I didn't want to be focusing on the marriage track. It seemed like a distraction from something more important.
And as you move through your life, you discover how like your mother you are. And you tell of discovering a manuscript your mother did get to write.
Right. Isn't that that
kind of
was
like a Harlequin style romance?
Yeah. And so at the time, that was in the, I don't know, around 2010 or so, I was, 2008. I was working at a Condé Nast glossy home decor magazine and feeling very tormented about it because it was a very unfeminist way to be spending my time, you know, writing captions about throw pillows and, you know, paint chips and so forth. And I would think, you know, ugh, if my mother had any idea, she would, you know, she'd be rolling over in her grave if she knew what I was up to. And then a friend of hers contacted me, and it turns out that my mother and this friend had co-written a romance novel together. And it was called Design for Love. The pseudonym was Rena Hart, and the heroine was Ivy Winter, and she was an interior decorator in New York City. So there it was on the page that I was living out a version of my mother's own fantasy life. Here I was, a single woman in New York City, working in the world of interiors, and to see that she had created a whole story around it showed me, you know, part of my mother that I didn't know. I didn't even know she knew what interior decorators were, you know, so far removed from my own experience growing up.
Well, let's get back just for a moment to the appeal of spinstership. Talk about, for a moment, the joy of solitude, and not just the few hours that people who are surrounded by others manage to grab and savor, but perhaps the solitude that comes from walking into an apartment or a house at the end of the day.
Oh, I'm glad that you're pinpointing it there, because I do find it hard almost to describe the pleasures of solitude, since it's the air I drink or the water I drink or the air I breathe. You know, to walk into a space that I have, you know, I'm wholly responsible for. I've worked hard to make the money to be able to rent this apartment. I have bought all of this furniture. I have arranged it exactly the way that I want it in ways that make me feel most comfortable. It's a domain that I am entirely the mistress of, but it's a very powerful feeling to live like that.
And one thing notable, I think, about your definition of spinstership is that you don't have to be a spinster forever for your whole life. I guess there are periods you can be a spinster for a portion of your life.
Yeah. And I'm just constitutionally, I'm not able to make grand claims like that, and I think they're dangerous. I'm suspicious of people who claim that they'll never do something or will, you know. And so for me, it just spinsterdom has been my adulthood so far, and it wasn't a conscious, deliberate choice. It was just something I was very intrigued by. I assumed I would get married because I didn't have a giant critique against marriage, but. Again, you know, I just kept choosing not to do this. And then the years pile up. And then here I am. I'll turn 43 this weekend. And this is the state I've remained in.
Do you think your mom would have liked to have tried spinstership for at least a while?
I think she would have loved it. Yes. Yeah.
It sounds like most of us would like to try.
Yeah.
It's very appealing to me right at this moment. But let me ask you, does it get old coming home to an empty space at times? Is there a flip side to it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, loneliness is a part of spinsterdom, just as loneliness is a part of any life. It's not that any of us ever avoid loneliness, but it can be more echoey and depressive, I think, when you're living alone for a very long time. And one thing I did, I got, you know, I'd say for about 7 years, I was euphoric living alone. And then I started to get just sick of myself, you know, to come home, these four walls, my things, ugh, you know. So I decided to live part-time in Los Angeles. I arranged it with my work, my job at the time. So I was living part-time in Brooklyn, part-time in Los Angeles. And while in Los Angeles, I was renting the bottom floor of the home of a married couple. So I suddenly had this kind of funny version of communal co-housing. So we shared the kitchen and the dining room and the public spaces and the pool. It was a beautiful house. And then I had my own, you know, private area downstairs, you know, kind of like the spinster apartment, really, you know, or like the mother-in-law apartment or something. And I found that, you know, that's another thing that we're seeing writ large, too, in America itself, that there are more and varied ways of people are thinking about their living arrangements. So it was fun for me to try that one.
Before we get to the break, I'd like to get to an email from Donna. She says, I have a copy of the marriage certificate of my great-grandmother and great-grandfather who married in 1907. At the time, she was only 19 years old and is listed on the certificate as spinster, hardly old yeah. enough to be left on the shelf, but perhaps that's because our contemporary understanding of the word is different than it was in 1907. Age 19 and a spinster. But you know, a century or so ago, you came of age a lot earlier.
Yeah, exactly. So age 18, in the eyes of the law, you were a spinster back in the day. And that's another really interesting thing about the word is how the age of marriage and changes. So the age of consent and the average age of marriage is always ever changing. So the spinster is never actually one specific thing. And I keep meaning to look into, and I can't believe I haven't done this yet, but when we stopped using spinster officially on marriage certificates, because it's a lot later than you'd think. I've heard people who got married in the 1980s, you know, they were listed as a spinster.
Really? Okay, we are chatting this hour with Kate Bullock, author of the book Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. If this is your choice, your experience, tell us about it. Are people always trying to fix you up? How do you handle it? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain, and this is Radio Times. This hour, Kate Bullock is turning the image of spinster on its head. She has been single all her adult life, a choice she has relished at times, and she's written a book called Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 888-477-9499. And Kate, going into the break, I asked the question of our audience, are people always trying to fix you up if you are single, and how do you handle it? And, you know, you've been single all your life. At this late stage, are people still trying to find you the perfect mate?
Oh, well, you know, keep in mind that when I'm single in that I'm unmarried, but I'm always in and out of relationships. So, yeah, people are always trying to set me up when I'm unmated, whatever that would be called. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people really think of single people as people who are constantly on the lookout, and single people are defined in terms of their singleness and how to unsingle them and get them into a couple. People are very fixated on that.
Ah, yes, that was my next question. Are they more comfortable if you are part of a couple? Do they feel you need to be part of a couple? Do you still have folks in your circle who feel that way?
I think so, yeah. That's all. Even in a place like New York City, where everybody is so liberal and progressive, I don't know, maybe this will get us back to biology or something, but I think just socially, people are more comfortable with couples around. When, you know, if they're coupled, people like to live in a coupled world. It just is more organized and comprehensible to other people.
Yeah. In your book, you focus on five female writers. You call them your spinster awakeners. Just love that phrase. But what exactly does it mean?
Well, so the term awakener I borrowed from Edith Wharton. She uses it in her memoir to describe the books and thinkers that guided her own intellectual journey. I really liked that idea, that and I wanted to apply it to these women who I had been thinking about and following for so long. So, you know, in my 20s, I started accumulating examples of women who had lived single lives. And it, just as a hobby or a habit, it was very comforting to me to learn about them and read about them, read their biographies, read the books about them, read the books that they had written. And through this, I created a conversation with them in my head that helped me think about my own life and create a way of thinking or sort of shaping a life that wasn't conforming to the standard trajectory that I thought that I would be part of. And I think of them as I really was filling in trying to create a conversation that I had lost with my mother, that the way I had always made sense of myself growing up was through talking with her. And so, you know, I was 23 when she died, to embark on, you know, on my adulthood without her felt very scary. And these single women who I would start talking to in my head were replicating a conversation that I might have had with her. And so I like the term awakeners because they weren't heroines. These weren't people that I was trying to be. I didn't want to copy them. Their differences were essential to my interest in them. What they were showing me, awakening me to different ideas and ways of doing things that I wouldn't have thought of on my own.
And they are essayist Maeve Brennan, columnist Neith Boyce, poet Edna St. Vincent Millay, novelist Edith Wharton, and feminist and social reformer Charlotte Perkins Gilman, correct?
Yes.
And they were spinsters at times. Some of them did marry.
Yeah, all of them married at some point. And each of them, when I intersected with her, she would be single. That's how I would come across. So for instance, Neith Boyce, who was a journalist and novelist at the turn of the last century, I first came across her through a column she wrote for Vogue in the year 1898 called The Bachelor Girl, about her decision to never marry. And she seemed like the most wildly independent dream girl I could possibly imagine. I had no idea that that conversation and critique around marriage was going on during that time period. And
sure.
So she really was a spinster heroine to me until I learned that she got married, which is really disappointing.
Well, how did she support herself as a bachelor girl?
So she was one of these, the thousands of women were flooding the workforce in the 1890s, and as well as universities. So she worked as a reporter at a daily newspaper in New York City and loved it, loved the sense of power and security she got from making her own way, and had a little apartment on Washington Square Park, which I happened to unknowingly be walking by every day. I was in graduate school at NYU at the time. And you know, she lived a life very much like the kind of lives we live today as single women. I think that period of the new woman, the new women, the bachelor girl of the 1890s was a very powerful moment to be a single woman in America.
And they were called bachelor girls?
Yeah. Yep. That was another term.
So why did the word bachelor not stick as it pertains to women?
I don't know. I mean, maybe because it was a bachelor girl, maybe it was the girl, because we eventually, you know, now that we call women women and girls has fallen out of fashion, and maybe part of it. I don't know.
Okay, well, this actually brings us to a Facebook comment from Josephine. She asks, why perpetuate this derogatory word, meaning spinster? It already sounds archaic and should be retired rather than revived. So, Kate, what is your reaction to Josephine's sentiment?
Oh, I just think it's more fun to revive it. There's so much history encapsulated in that one word. I don't want to let go of it. And the negativity around it is not the whole story. So to me, it's a word that's just fascinating and deserves to stick around.
And we've got a call from Lorraine. She's in Fairmount. Lorraine, you're live on Radio Times.
Yes, I wanted to point out the old movie with John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara called The Quiet Man. And he falls in love with a beautiful young Irish woman, and the matchmaker puts them together, and he, in the formal documents, it says her name, Spinster. You know, and it's so, I guess we would think it's funny that he would call her a spinster because she's so young, and it sort of belies that idea we have now of a spinster being an old person, but it looked like it was the common term in those days for an unmarried woman.
Sure, and you know, having not seen The Quiet Man, when was it set, Lorraine? What decade? Do you remember back in the early 1900s or mid-1900s? Tough to say. Sorry for throwing you that curveball.
I have Google on my phone, but I have to switch switch you out to get it, pull it up.
Well, listen.
I think it was in color, so it must have been done in the 50s. It was probably set more like in the 30s or 40s.
Got it. All right, Lorraine, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. So let's get back to your spinster awakeners, Kate Bolick. Apparently, your favorite poet as a girl was Edna St. Vincent Millay. What attracted you to her?
Oh, she was so passionate. And just all the exclamation points and em dashes in her poetry. And just she was a very passionate woman. And as a teenager, it was really exciting to read poetry that mirrored my own internal, you know, torments and flights of fancy instead of the kind of staid, stiff stuff that I was used to in school. I found a book of hers around the house. That's how I first discovered her.
And her mother divorced her father, which was unusual in those times.
It was, yeah. So he wasn't an abusive man. I mean, women were known to leave abusive husbands and communities would be okay with that. But he was just an ineffective man. And Edna's mother was a very strong, powerful woman who just basically didn't have time for this loaf about guy. She had these three daughters and her own work to do. So she left him and raised the girls on her own.
And eventually in 1923, she won the Pulitzer for poetry.
Yeah.
And then she married.
So right. So for about 6 years, Edna St. Vincent Millay was the most famous single woman in America. And this was back when being a poet meant, you know, being a rock star, or she at least turned the profession into rock star status. And she was her poems were showing a kind of freedom around sexuality that women were newly experiencing. So she was giving voice to the times in a way that that women really needed to hear and responded to. So because she's lives in history in that way as being that person, it really surprised me to realize it was only 6 years that she lived like that until her marriage, although the marriage itself was an open marriage, so it wasn't a standard type.
So you write in your book reference to, I guess, Edna and her sexual freedom, and perhaps in your situation, I wasn't proud about our situation as I came to think of it, and it didn't make me remotely happy in any rational or traditional sense. And I guess you're talking about your own relationships. And yet I loved it absolutely for how free I felt and alive. You go on to say, I grew increasingly disembodied, or maybe only bodied is more accurate, retreating ever further into a counterintuitive sexual solipsism. So if you you can explain this perhaps a little bit for our audience. This is a time in your life in which you kind of perhaps went through a phase as Edna had gone through.
Yes. I was one of those people who always had a boyfriend. So from the ages of 14 to 29, I was in long-term relationships. It's the only way I'd ever experienced life or myself. I just was always a girlfriend. And this freaked me out. Around age 28, I started thinking, this is, how am I going to turn into a grown-up if I don't know how to take care of myself or be alone? I'm always depending on somebody else. I've always got somebody around. So I set out to try to be on my own. And see what that would be like for me. And I was really overwhelmed by our present day dating and sexual norms where, you know, there was something so safe about being in long-term relationships for all those years growing up. And so to be an adult 30-year-old person living in New York City, I shouldn't have been so intimidated, but because I had been sequestered for so long, I really was. And so what I'm talking about in that passage that you just just read is I got involved in a relationship, you know, you could call it just because it was existing, but it was, you know, no commitments, no nothing. He wasn't my boyfriend. I wasn't his girlfriend. And it was exhilarating to be able to have a relationship that wasn't defining me and that there were no promises, no nothing. It almost didn't exist. Mm-hmm.
So, but you wrote, you grew increasingly disembodied, as I read before, retreating ever further into a counterintuitive sexual solipsism. So, if you grew increasingly disembodied, was there something you found essential missing in all the temporary intimacy, or no regrets?
No, for me, it didn't work at all. Trying that out was interesting, but I can't do casual sex. I don't have a casual register on me. So to try that out felt important to do, but I found it to be very unsatisfying emotionally and uninteresting. It just kept me, I don't know. Yeah, it was boring, ultimately.
We are talking this hour with Kate Bolick, author of the book Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. And lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And we do have a tweet from Kay, who says, reminds me of local artist Ursula Rucker's On Loneliness, which she says can be sweet. So I guess there's a tie between loneliness and a certain sweetness of sentiment. Do you find that sometimes, Kate?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. I mean, I think that, I mean, what it makes me think of is how being mindful of death makes us more appreciative of life. So there is something about loneliness that can be a bittersweet experience and also make you feel more appreciative of connection when you are experiencing that.
Well, we all get lonely at times, obviously. How do you deal with it?
Oh, God, that's a great question. I really had to learn. For a long time, I didn't know what to do. I would just, you know, lie in my bed and cry or something. And over time, I got so much better at learning how to structure my life so that it felt balanced and that I wasn't, you know, that I had to figure out what I need to get through a day, what makes me feel good, how much, you know, I need some social time, but not too much social time. I need, you know, time alone to be reading, but too much time like that can start to feel sort of too interior and claustrophobic for me. And so just learning how to, just getting a sense of my own appetites and temperament really made loneliness less present for me, I think. And but, you know, in that said, I think of loneliness as being something that is always there somehow. It's and you just feel it more acutely at some times than others, but it's an ever-present kind of feeling.
Sure, part of the human condition.
Yeah.
So earlier this hour, you referenced the cat lady in you know, in association, at least it could be associated with spinsterhood. Unfortunately, women as opposed to men tend to be viewed as cat ladies or even bag ladies if they live alone for long periods. Could you address that?
Yeah, I mean, it's right. We don't
I love
have,
cats.
Right. Cats are great. And I mean, it's interesting to think, too, about the relationship between cats and women is so ancient. And I like to think of cats as being almost like single women themselves because they, you know, historically, you know, cats are kind of on the margins. They're, you know, the dogs are bounding about and yipping and being bachelors. But whereas a cat is a more mysterious and kind of on the periphery, kind of less visible. But as far as the cat lady and the bag lady, right, women have these specters that exist, that culture is ratifying all the time, and we don't have a male equivalent. So it's just another way of controlling women and pressuring them into a married state because the alternative is so dire.
Mm. And at times in your book, you confess you were fearful of becoming a bag lady, as you put it. Income was erratic, and you began to understand the appeal of marriage, mutual support, splitting bills, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I'd say it's not, I didn't fear becoming a bag lady. It's that I understood the fear for the first time. I had never understood it before. And But, you know, life in New York City, trying to be a writer, I was so broke, struggling so much. And I was questioning myself a lot. Like, why am I doing this? Why have I decided to go my own way like this? It's so insecure. It's so unstable. And I get it. Like, I get the fear now of winding up on my own. And but I also came to see that the fear of the bag lady is, becoming the bag lady is really the fear of being unloved, because the bag lady is without a home, without anybody to take care of her. And that's what she's encapsulating as well, is that very human essential fear.
And one of your spinster awakeners actually does end up on the street. Was that Charlotte Perkins Gilman?
No, that was Maeve Brennan.
And OK.
So Maeve had she was Irish and moved to New York by herself when she was in her 20s and ended up becoming a staff writer for The New Yorker, and for several decades wrote under the pen name The Long-Winded Lady. And she lived most of her life alone. She was briefly married for 5 years, ages 37 to 42, and then otherwise lived entirely by herself. And she was, you know, operating at mid-century, which was the absolute worst time in American history to be a single woman, next to the Salem witch trial. So that was the absolute worst time to be single. You know, of the 200 people burned at the stake, most of them were poor single mothers or wealthy widows whose wealth inspired jealousy. And then, you know, flash ahead to the 1950s, only 17% of women were single, compared to 53% today. So we had very few single women. And those who were, you know, it was the stigma has never been greater as it was then. And that's when Maeve Brennan was living and thriving as a single woman. And so lived very bravely, in my opinion, but also struggled with mental health issues and did end up an actual bag lady living on the streets, which was very devastating for me to discover.
All right. One more thought on Maeve after the break. But first, we do have to take a break. We're chatting this hour with Kate Bolick, who is author of the book Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. And she embraces the word spinster. We're talking about that this hour on Radio Times. 888-477-9499 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Mosca Wayne. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Mosca Wayne. Kate Bolick has been single all her adult life, a choice she has relished at times. She has written Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own, and she embraces the word spinster. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. And Kate, before we move on in the conversation, did just want to touch base briefly on Maeve Brennan's life. She was one of your so-called spinster awakeners, and she did end up living on the streets of New York. She did have schizophrenia. What did you take away from her life?
Well, an exciting thing that happened during the research of the book is I found her, one of her very last friends. So this is someone who had not made it into her biography and who a lot of people didn't know about. And through this friend, I learned about this whole chapter of Maeve's life that had gone unrecorded, and that she, you know, she was living between different writers' colonies and meeting all kinds of women and making these new friendships. And so that she actually thrived in a way that was not clear, you know, through the story that was told through the biography. And I came to see her as living the kind of modern urban life we're also accustomed to now, but at the time was so unusual. But she, you know, she never owned her own home. She was always renting, and she found a lot of just excitement and interest in lots of what sociologists would call weak ties, rather than, you know, for her, the strong ties of family were oppressive. Ireland is a very, you know, sexist country. She was being told by her family that she should marry. You know, she didn't want to be domesticated, and she wanted to live this unfettered life in the city. And by she was able to do that because she had a constellation of friends and coworkers, and, you know, like the server at the cafe, or, you know, just the texture and fabric of urban life sustained her in a way that many people live now.
Interestingly, your spinster awakeners, as you call them, all seem to hail from what, the late 19th, early 20th century. Why is that?
Right. So at first, I had no idea. You know, I just kept being drawn to that time period, and I didn't understand it. really until I sat down to write about it in the book and came to understand, you know, as I was piecing together a history of single women in America, which doesn't quite exist. So I had to, you know, sort of go to a lot of different sources in order to pull that history together, and realized that, you know, in the late 1800s, that there was this, as I was mentioning this earlier, but women were flooding the workforce in universities in unprecedented numbers. It was a time of great promise and excitement around being a woman and being alone. And so that's why I kept being drawn to it, is because it was such an appealing time period. And they were also, the women who were writing about their single lives then were writing in a voice that I found so refreshing. And in this, you know, this was at the time when I started thinking about the single woman as an historical archetype and really looking into it. It was the year 2000 when culture was showing us that the only way to be a single woman was to be Carrie Bradshaw or Bridget Jones. So, you know, frivolous and fabulous, or desperate and pathetic. And, you know, I knew, of course, that there were other ways of being, and that, of course, the second wave of the women's movement had created a huge critique and shown us many ways of being an unmarried woman. But that had all disappeared. And so suddenly it was a sort of strange blank time as far as what a culture was showing us. So to find women, you know, to find these examples 100 years ago was exciting. It was the kind of reflection of myself that I wanted to see. It just happened to be a long time ago. But that time period, you know, has more parallels than you would think, you know, with now, you know, now that, you know, just with these new numbers of women, unmarried women, and where women are in the workforce and out earning men in terms of graduate degrees, you know, there are similarities between these two time periods.
Back to the 21st century for a moment. Carrie Bradshaw aside, is there any real flesh and blood woman whom you admire who might be an awakener in this day and age?
Well, you know, Gloria Steinem is a great example. And I like that. You know, she was single most of her life. She did marry. I think she was 60, wasn't she, when she married? And he eventually died, and she's never remarried, though I'm sure she has partners. So she's a great example of someone who has lived according to her own, you know, internal compass. And that, you know, I like that she didn't swear that she would never marry. Uh-huh. You know, she let it happen when it happened.
Yeah. I wonder how she would look at the word spinster. Of course, we don't have an answer, but it's an interesting thought.
Oh, I would love to talk to her. Yeah.
All right. To the phones we go. Lisa in Wilmington, Delaware. Hello. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason why I'm calling is because you haven't talked about the origin of the word spinster, and I happened upon it when I visited the Colonial Plantation, which is in Delaware County. And I am curious to know how something, it was very gratifying when I learned this, by the way, how something that I felt was inherently positive became such a derogatory term, because it was an integral part of colonial life. And the Colonial Plantation talks about, it's, you know, it's a William Penn land grant. So it goes back to the late 17th century.
Sure. Kate Bullock, you want to address this? We did touch on it briefly earlier on, but worth taking another look.
Yeah. And so what part are you talking about specifically?
What I learned there is that the word spinster really comes from one who spins.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. And in colonial life, you raised flax and you had sheep in order to get fibers to spin into yarn. Because if you wanted clothing, you had to produce your own fiber, spin it into your own yarns, knit it into your own cloth, or weave it. And the woman of the household would do the weaving. The loom would be in the attic.
So at least I don't mean to. I'm just kind of looking at the clock. But I think you do make an important point about the importance of the person who at the time in colonial times was the spinster in terms of the economic well-being of the household.
Oh, sure. From dawn until dusk. And she taught all those samplers that you see in museums, you know, the alphabets, the embroidery. She was the teacher.
Lisa, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Richard in Paoli, Pennsylvania. Richard, welcome.
Yes, I heard the author a little earlier refer to a man as a do-nothing man. It was about 10 minutes ago. I just wondered how the author would feel if a male author was on and referred to a woman as a do-nothing woman.
I don't know if you meant that about all men, Kate.
No, not at all. I was talking specifically about Edna St. Vincent Millay's father and how her mother felt about the father and why she left him. So I think it's a fair description of how she felt. I mean, that's how she wrote about it.
Thanks, Richard, for the call to Radio Times. We really appreciate it. Eventually, in the late 19th century, a new moniker was born, the New Woman. Who was she? Who was she, Kate Bullock?
So the New Woman was one of these many women coming from small towns and rural communities to urban centers to work and live on her own. And it was Henry James came up with the moniker initially, and it was derogatory, actually, but it came to be embraced and celebrated. And there was the popular image of the New Woman was a tall, athletic, fit woman striding purposefully down the sidewalk, you know, from her apartment or her room in her boarding house to the factory or the newspaper or the office where she had her job. And she really thrived. It was a great reflection of women, of a way to be a woman, a way to be an independent woman. And she was sort of eclipsed by the flapper. And that was signaled the end of the New Woman.
Mm. Notable, in 1898, women still laced themselves into corsets so tightly, it's believed they actually breathed differently than men.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so this idea, you know, these were late Victorians. They had very rigid ideas about what women and men should do and who they were. And all of this was changing so swiftly. So we needed new language. We needed the term the New Woman, the bachelor girl, different ways of talking about who these women were, who were choosing to live differently.
We've got a comment from Jean. She says, in regards to motherhood and being a spinster or couples choosing not to have children, could we comment on this? Let's choose the first part of that, motherhood and being a spinster. So being a spinster, does that necessarily preclude children?
Well, historically, yes. I think that's the one thing, you know, all the varying reputations of who the spinster is or how she has been perceived by society, she's always never had children. And so we are living in a fascinating time now where we're seeing the rise of the choice mom, and more women than ever before are having children on their own, you know, through, you know, sperm banks or adoption. So now the spinster can have a child.
And you know, you said yourself that your thoughts on being single are fluid. So, I mean, do you foresee, this is a personal question, you don't have to answer it, and you can say so, but your thoughts on children?
Oh,
in your life?
I probably am never having children, and that's something I have really thought a lot about. It's a really hard decision to make. And I think that if it happens that I never do, I think I'll be sad about it to some degree, but it just still doesn't seem like the right thing for me to do.
All right. We've got a comment from Sarah. She says, I think the negative connotations of spinster and cat lady have to do with an anxious or fearful reaction to the independence of a single woman. Historically, there is a feeling of anxiety in men, but not only in men, probably in women and couples too, associated with a woman who does not need a man or a partner. It's also why some people prefer dogs to cats. Cats appear not to need them. We touched on that a little bit earlier, but you know, she brings up an interesting point, the single woman with the couple. She says historically there's a feeling of anxiety associated with a woman who does not need a man or a partner. And you know, probably in women and couples too. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we have a whole, you know, history of movies where the single woman is the femme fatale. And that's also, you know, originates in the workplace when we had women working with men for the first time. How threatening. Just imagine what that was like to, you know, just assumptions about the social order, to have these women in offices or et cetera, you know, not just living their own way, not needing men the way that other women had convinced themselves that they needed men. And so that still plays out today. And I think that's also just a kind of a social psychology issue as well about how groups are formed. And when you have, you know, like I'm thinking of my brother right now, who's married and lives, you know, among a lot of couples and small families in Connecticut. And when they just don't, single people aren't part of their lives. And when a single person comes through, it kind of sends a ripple through a little electricity. You know, things get shaken up a little bit.
There were hints of your evolving spinstership early on. Kate Bullock, you kept journals. And in looking back, I came across some really terrific lines here. Who wouldn't love this? A long, perfect spinster wish of a Sunday. Read all day, took two naps.
I'm a big
napper. Does that about sum it up?
Yes. The rallying cry of the spinster.
Exactly. Well, as I think we referred to earlier, I think many of us would like to try that at least for a short period of time. Men maybe as well. Do you see the word spinster becoming a part of the lexicon?
No, I don't. I think it's a really fun way to talk about these issues and a fun way to be connected to history, but I really don't think it will become a common word again.
Hmm. And spinster wishes, you talked about that a little bit earlier on. What are spinster wishes exactly? And what are some of yours?
Well, you know, for me, when I was writing that to myself in my journals when I was in my 20s, that was because I had never been alone. I'd always been a daughter and a big sister and a girlfriend. And so to me, the idea of being alone was incomprehensible. It was something I had to wish and fantasize about and come up with a name for, the spinster wish. That's how unreal it seemed to me to think of being able to spend so much time alone. And so for many years, it was a wish. It was something I didn't know how to pursue. And it wasn't until, you know, around 30 that it became a more conscious pursuit. And then not until 35 that I really understood that I wanted to be unmarried. So it's been a very slow process for me. And so now it doesn't exist as a wish anymore. It's my life. I wished for it for a long time and it came true.
How does living as a single person differ in your 40s as opposed to your 20s and 30s, in your experience anyway?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I can't speak personally to the 20s since I was so girlfriended up all the time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look, you know, friends had, you know, I'd say 30s, it's a pretty anxious time. That's the most anxious period for being a single woman, because that's when you're feeling the pressure of biology and cultural expectation the strongest. And you're really having to make your own decisions then. And so once that happens, and it tends to happen around 35, I see that again and again in interviews that I do and research that I read, when a single woman owns her life and owns, just embraces her state of unmarriedness, she becomes much happier and much more at ease with her life, and then continues on like that into her 40s. And then, you know, and then at that point, hopefully you're much more established professionally, have enough economic security. So it's a much more stable and easy thing to be a single person in your 40s, if that's something that you've chosen.
So what mental and emotional steps do you take to embrace spinsterhood or single life?
Well, for
what do you have to toss out emotionally?
Expectations and the expectations that you have internalized, because, you know, unthinkingly, because they're just what culture gives us. So, I mean, that's how it worked for me. I kept thinking, oh, I'm dating this guy. Do I want to marry him or not? Is this the one? You know, just that kind of anxiety that I put on my romantic life. And then, you know, around 35 and another boyfriend and I broke up, and I thought, wait a minute, you know, I keep thinking I'm going to marry one of these people, but I never do. So obviously this is not what I want. So it's just owning my own unconscious decisions, basically.
Kate Bullock, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Kate Bullock is author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. And as always, you can find out more about Radio Times, including our Facebook page and podcasts, by visiting whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane on Radio Times. Thank you so much for joining us.